Lads on Tour, Theme Tune here. Good evening and welcome to Lads on Tour. With us this evening, we have obviously myself, started with COVID. We have Dr. Ivermectin.
Hey.
And we have Brent Lee. And Brent, hey. Joining us this evening is Lydia Green from backtothevax.com. So Lydia, do you want to tell us about what you're currently doing? And then either we'll have a few questions and we'll get started like that.
So I used to be an anti-vaxxer for well over 12 years and dabbled in other conspiracies as well, just because I grew up that way. My parents are from the former Yugoslavia and they're very mistrusting of authority. So I kind of grew up with that. And when my daughter was born back in 2008, I was pretty pro-science. Like, I didn't really look into vaccine conspiracies that much at the time. And I went to all my prenatal visits and had a flu shot while pregnant even. And then when it came to my daughter's first vaccine appointment, I was a little scared to vaccinate her. I don't know if I had already come into contact with some anti-vax stuff at the time, but I just remember thinking, once I do this, I can't undo it. And like, what if I harm her, you know, and damage her somehow and I can't undo it. And that kind of stuck with me, but we went through it. I remember my husband saying, like, you know, they're here to help babies be healthier. They're here to, you know, vaccines are to protect our children from disease. Like, they're not here to hurt children. I was like, yeah, that's true. And I went through with the vaccination and my daughter started crying later that evening. And it was a very scary cry. My daughter's a very happy baby. She's very easy in terms of being a first-time mom. I was able to keep her happy most of the time. And I don't think I ever really heard her cry other than fussing a little here and there. But if I attended to her right away, she never cried. And so later that night, she started screaming and it scared me. I tried to comfort her. I tried to feed her. She didn't want to feed. She wasn't really looking at me much. She would sleep really deeply. And she would cry this high-pitched cry in between. And I stayed up all night with her. And the next morning I called public health. And the nurse kind of, you know, told me that sounded pretty normal. But if I was really worried, I would take her in. And, you know, I was just being a first-time mom with lots of anxiety and that my kid was probably fine. And I kind of felt embarrassed, kind of dumb, kind of blown off, like a mixture of like, you know, feelings. And at that point, she still wasn't quite herself. So I still was quite worried, but also felt dumb at the same time. Like, it was not a good feeling at the end of that. Going into the next day, my daughter started to improve, but the damage that had already been done, you know, I went online to the same parenting group I was on. It was a natural parenting group called Mothering. It still exists. They're very anti-establishment, anti-medicine, pro, you know, breastfeed, cloth diaper. They have niche groups for everything from, you know, like, you would think that cloth diapering wouldn't be this like defensive niche group, but it is. And intactivism, like, they're really against circumcision and just anything that they can turn into some form of activism, they'll turn into. So it's intactivism, lactivism, you know, it's mothers coming together and promoting these natural ideas as best, and everything else is, you know, you're not trying hard enough. If you're not doing it the hard way, you're not trying hard enough and you don't want what's best. If you want what's best, you'll do everything. Everything is from scratch. Everything is the hard way, you know. And I talked to these women and they convinced me my daughter had cryoencephalitis. It was in the, you know, in the insert. It's actually an artifact from DTP, which was a higher risk vaccine, still quite low risk, but it had higher incidence of side effects. And when they made DTaP, which is acellular pertussis as opposed to whole cell, it has less side effects, but they just carried over the same reported effects in the inserts. So I was left feeling like my daughter's brain was swelling and she was screaming in pain. And I thought, I'm never letting her have DTaP again. And started reading into vaccines and stopped vaccinating. Like, I took her to her 4 months. She got a couple of other shots outside of DTaP. But then, and the more I read and the more I was exposed to, I just kind of believed that no vaccine should be given to my children ever at that point. So I had two more kids, didn't vaccinate them either at all. And then COVID happened and I started seeing some like cracks in the veneer of anti-vax. Like, I know, I'm sure Brent has noticed it too with some of the hypocrisies. Like they claim like sanitation cured everything and not vaccines. But then when they're being asked to wear a mask, they're like, no. So you're like, wait a minute. I thought we said we would do other measures to prevent disease. I thought that's what we were about, that other measures work. And so you kind of start seeing these things and you're like, and then of course, a lot of the more sketchier conspiracy theories started making groups like Satanic Panic and Flat Earth, lots of other, I'm like, this doesn't really align with my values. Like, I'm not that far. Like, I could believe maybe 9/11 was an inside job, but you know, like I'm not as willing to go as far as the earth is flat, you know? So, and that's how I, you know, became an anti-vaxxer and slowly started to come out of it around the time COVID started.
Okay. Thank you. I would take it away then.
All right. So I had a few questions. You've already answered some of them. So I'll sort of rephrase one of the ones I've got.
Sure.
I've always sort of thought of anti-vax as like more of a gateway drug to say like other alternative medicine. So did you ever really get like hard into other alt med like homeopathy or anything?
Oh yeah. I never really liked homeopathy because it just doesn't make sense to me. It's too out there. I used to be a pharmaceutical chemist, like a quality control chemist at a pharmaceutical plant. So I have some scientific background and I could never wrap my head around nothing doing something. Like it just, other than that, it was self-limiting and went away on its own. It doesn't make any sense to me. But other herbal remedies, because it is something, there could be something potentially in there that is working, like that kind of made sense. I would use more herbal remedies, let things run their course. Fever is a big belief in the anti-vax circles. You let your children have fever, even if they're really uncomfortable. I mean, and they're and like with everything that they believe, there is a slight twist of truth to it, but no pediatrician out there is going to say you should let your children suffer. You know, you can give them, yes, fever is a good immune response and there is, you know, data to show it's helpful. It's your body's way of dealing with infection. But if your kid is in pain and suffering and can't sleep, you can give them some Tylenol. It's okay. Like you're not slowing things down or putting them in danger because you gave them some Advil so they could sleep. Like it's silly. But, you know, that's how they all work, is like they'll find like a tiny sliver of something that sounds plausible and then they'll extrapolate data from that that's absolutely not true. Now I know that now. I didn't know that then. I just thought I had the correct information. You know, I just didn't want to believe that I was wrong because it is very cult-like while you're in there. And I have Crohn's and I tried to treat my Crohn's disease and I have severe, nasty Crohn's disease. And I tried to treat it several times to no avail, getting sicker and sicker. And it's always my fault. That's what I noticed. Like I didn't exclude the right things. There must be cross-contamination. Another thing that's common is if you feel sicker, it must be die-off or the toxins leaving your body. They always have a reason why you feel worse. And it's never their fault. It's always your fault or die-off or toxins or whatever. Detox is a big buzzword in these groups. And, you know, they explain these shady, plausible sounding mechanisms that actually have nothing to do with health or science at all. And you kind of stop evaluating things with a scientific lens after a while.
And they always have to have a reason, right? So they can't, you know, like I've had to go to the doctor with sort of minor things and we didn't really understand what was happening. But they can't, these guys can't do that if they're saying that they're smarter and they know more than than the medical community. They have to have a reason.
Exactly. And sometimes the medical community doesn't have an answer at first. Like you come in and it's a mystery. There are medical mysteries, you know, where people have health issues and they don't know right away what's wrong with you. And that can be very frustrating, I'm sure, like as a patient where, you know, you're suffering, you want to know what it is so you could get to the bottom of it and help yourself. And you can't really do that if you don't know what it is. So I can get why people, you know, are drawn to alt med and anti-vax because it kind of offers this way you know, and like I said, like we have been taught since we were little that if anything is worth having, it's hard work, you know, and if you do it the easy way, you're doing it wrong. And I don't know why we think that, but we do. And so when they offer, like, if you eat this really strict diet and take these supplements and spend your money and see a naturopath, you know, they'll figure out the root cause of your disease. And, I mean, there's something to eating better for sure. I mean, a lot of people feel better once they stop eating processed food, but that doesn't mean that alternative medicine has all the answers, because your doctor will also tell you to eat better. Right.
Yeah.
What would you have done when you were like inside, as it were, if someone would have confronted you with like, hey, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has got $50 million in the bank or something like that? Would you have done the deflection to, oh, well, it's nothing compared to what Pfizer makes or something like that?
Exactly. I wouldn't think that anything of it, because big pharma makes money. But at the same time, like, big pharma is also regulated and natural health isn't. So at the end of the day, they're also making money and they don't actually have to prove anything of theirs works. I mean, they can pay for studies. These companies, these natural health companies, can put in the money to pay for studies to prove their products work. They don't, for a good reason, because they don't want to know that answer. It's not because they're too poor or big pharma is bullying them or, you know, whatever. It's because they don't want to know, because you can't sell that.
What sort of happens? So I want to sort of contrast this in a way, compare and contrast with sort of Brent's experience in more the traditional like truther world.
Mm-hmm.
What happens like in the Facebook groups or the social media, etc., when you start having doubts about it? Like, they just say you're being paid, or whatever, like that.
I've definitely been told that since leaving. But if you're in the group and you have doubts, they will, you know, do their best to convince you that these studies are true and these studies aren't, and this smaller study is true, but they can't do a bigger one because they won't like the answer. And it's very cherry picked and cataloged. Like, a lot of these people will have binders of information that they have on the go to steer people back into anti-vax should they start questioning it out loud in that group. That's why you have to leave your echo chamber in order to get the big picture, because if you don't, that they have this like curated list of information that they will draw from and show you and scare you with. And if that doesn't work, there's anecdotes. There's always anecdotes. And I can sit there and go, I get the whole anecdote thing, because I shared my daughter's story as an anecdote after I was convinced she had cryoencephalitis in these groups. I'd say, good for you, you know, like my time was more spent on forums like mothering. So I'd say, you know, my daughter had cryoencephalitis, I believe. And it was scary. She's scared. Like, I was never so scared for her. And I fully believed that she was in danger at that time. So my anecdote probably scared other people, because now, so there is also a benefit to convincing people that a reaction was much worse, because now you have more fodder. You have more scary stories to draw in more people. That's how they work. It's anecdotes and cherry-picked evidence to herd you right back in.
I'll say one final question from me. So what was sort of like the main thing which sort of gave you the biggest doubts when you were in there?
So when COVID occurred, I started getting paranoid. And again, just having a, I wasn't as far as gone as Brent, but I did believe in some conspiracies, and I always was kind of bracing myself for the collapse of the economy. And
did you buy gold or Bitcoin?
No, I didn't buy gold or Bitcoin. Bitcoin wasn't big, or wasn't as big back then, but I started to worry about, what if life gets harder? What if our healthcare system collapses? What if the economy collapses? And then I think of other countries where this did happen and these diseases came back, you know, Venezuela being a big example. Venezuela had excellent healthcare at one point, then, you know, all that stuff happened and their economy and healthcare system collapsed, and diphtheria and measles came back. And I, I know I'm not so far gone to think that if I give my kid vitamin C, they'll survive diphtheria. Diphtheria is pretty lethal. They used to call it the strangling angel. So I started thinking, like, what vaccines should I, you know, if I give my kids a few, just so that if things go bad, they have some protection. I started like weighing, like, is it, it might be worth the little bit of extra risk to get them vaccinated. And so I started wondering when I could vaccinate my youngest, who was just 2 years old. And I really believed that the blood-brain barrier didn't close until age two or three. That's a very common trope in anti-vax circles. And I just kind of took it verbatim. Like, I didn't really look into too much data. It just sounds plausible. Like, oh yeah, of course, like baby, everything is immature in a baby. Like, you would think that that was too. And so I'm like, what age does it actually fully mature? And then I realized I was like, not just a little wrong, like really wrong. Like, babies are born with an intact blood-brain barrier, and it's safe to vaccinate my kid from birth. Like, if that's the reason I wasn't. And that's when I couldn't, you know, lie to myself anymore. And I had to like really look into what else I could be wrong about, and started scrutinizing these long-held beliefs that I had. And I'll tell you that it was so uncomfortable psychologically. Like, it is, like, you can, if you think about it, when it does hit you, like, you could just feel the color drain from your face, and your stomach is doing flip-flops, and you're just like, what have I been doing? Like, what did I do? And that's how it felt for me when I started to realize like how wrong I was.
So yeah, so you're saying like it was quite a sudden change then?
Yeah, once I realized I was so wrong about something I've believed wholeheartedly for so many years, I couldn't not examine the other things I believed just as wholeheartedly.
I was going to say, I think that with anybody, if they, you know, change any sort of aspect of their belief system, particularly something that they're invested in,
yes,
that is going to be painful. And especially, you know, if somebody moves from being an anti-vaxxer to being pro-vaccination, or even the other way around, it does mean that their previous understanding and their previous actions were exposing the people around them or their children to unnecessary risk. So it's going to be painful.
Yeah. And it's not easy, even because when it comes to actually going through with it, like, you know, you're corrected now, but even then, now you have to make this appointment and catch your children up. And even doing that is still hard. In our group, which I haven't really gone into, our back to the vax movement that my partner Heather and I started, who was also a former anti-vaxxer, but from Texas, I'm from Canada. You know, that first visit is still fraught with anxiety. Like, you still play all those anecdotes and stories in your head, and you think like, what if the worst happens? What if they are right? What if I'm not right? What if I messed it up again? Like, you also at the same time question your judgment with everything now. Like, because you got it so wrong the first time, you kind of don't trust yourself, you know?
Yeah, like, I have the same thing. Like, am I right now? I was wrong before. Could I still be wrong? Yeah, I understand what you mean.
But once I took my kids in and they did get vaccines, and that nothing happened, like, outside of some minor side effects that are, you know, normal, it got easier. But that first appointment was very difficult, even though I knew, like, I was doing the right thing. It's almost like you've been brainwashed for so long to think that it was, like, I would worry for other people's children. Like, when they told me that they were taking their kids for the shots, and I would feel sick to my stomach. Like, I hope their kid doesn't die. I hope their kid isn't maimed. Like, I would legitimately worry for not just my own children, but other people's kids as well, when I heard they were getting vaccinated. Like, that's how badly I felt. I didn't become a nurse because of my stance on vaccination. I couldn't, you know, do something I didn't believe in. And that's where I don't understand nurses that are anti-vax. I think that's insanity. Like, as much as I was an anti-vaxxer, I couldn't become a nurse. And yet we have nurses that are shirking evidence-based medicine. Like, that's just learning about nursing practice now, that actually goes against like the foundations of nursing practice to do that. Like, I don't understand how you can do all this work and then like yeah, I don't believe in vaccines and I'm going to tell other people not to. Like, it just blows my mind.
You said something interesting there that, like, I find is different among the communities today. And that's where you kind of expressed like empathy and that you were worried about people who had vaxxed their children. Whereas today you see quite a lot of like gloating mm-hmm. among the anti-vaxxers and people like that.
Yeah, they almost wish bad things would happen.
Yeah, you've noticed this as well then.
Yeah, I've noticed that. Yeah, absolutely.
Because you'd see quite disgusting things. Like, I'm not saying it's everyone, but you'd see like, a mother would post a picture of her child and saying, I got the COVID vaccine today. And they're like, you're going to get heart attacks. You're going to get myocarditis. Mm-hmm. You know, like, is that really necessary?
It's not. And that was never something I've done. I've never said to any parent who just vaccinated their kids, like, oh, I hope your kid doesn't get autism. Like, I could never do that. Like, that's not, I might think it. If their kid was autistic, I might think maybe it was the vaccine. But I would never say that to someone. And this is
Do you think that's changed? Like, was it? Yeah, it has changed.
The anti-vax community has become more vitriolic, more extreme, more violent. Like, when they attacked Richard Pan, who's a senator, he's a pediatrician and a senator in California, and a bunch of protesters, you know, surrounded his office and threw menstrual blood on him and said that was the blood of the children he killed. Like, that's bananas. Like, what?
Yeah, that says more about the person throwing the blood than the person receiving.
But there is also in this regard quite a bit of sort of like anti-Semitism. Like, they call Jewish doctors like as bad as the Auschwitz doctor, Josef Mengele, and all stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, Peter Hotez gets that a lot. I don't know if you know who that is, but he's.
Yeah, yeah. He's the one who made Corbevax. He's a hero.
Yeah, he is a hero. And he, you know, he dedicated most of his life to rare tropical diseases. And there's no money in that. And he made his vaccine, Corbevax, I think it's called.
Yeah, that's what it's called.
There's no patent. He made it patent free because he wanted the poorer countries to get it. And his design was specifically easy storage, you know, so that, you know, if you didn't have this huge fridge or freezer, it still would, you could vaccinate, you know, people with it. And people calling him like Mengele, it's like disgusting. He is such a kind man.
So I want to dive into why do you think this is? Because what I'm seeing is that it seems like in your time of being anti-vax, it was more based on like vaccinations that you give children.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about protecting children. Whereas today it seems more like it's a political tool or a political choice.
Yeah. And I think it's because, okay, so if you're a person and you don't have small children, you're not thinking about vaccines, right? Like, maybe you get a flu shot, maybe you don't, you know, 50.
Yeah, that's my position.
But yeah,
like, I've got no children, so I don't really have to think about this type of thing.
Not thinking about vaccines at all, unless you have little kids. Yeah, but people do, right? Now people do, whether they have kids or not, or if they don't have little kids, it doesn't matter. You're thinking of vaccination all the time. And then with the political, you know, strife that's happening, I think it was only natural for it to become a politically divisive thing, even though it shouldn't be. And then a lot of this stuff, because a lot of these conspiracies are rooted in, or sorry, a lot of the myths around vaccine are rooted in conspiracy. It's kind of like gateway drug to conspiracy theories too. And so now you see all these people who would have never entertained a conspiracy theory had it not been for this push for vaccination are now reading about things they've never would have given a chance to. And so now you're seeing people being exposed to all kinds of conspiracy theories. And now you see more people getting involved than you did even 5 years ago.
Yeah, like 10, 15 times the amount of people that used to be involved.
Like, the amount of people that believe that Hillary Clinton eats babies has gone up a lot.
Yeah, 100 million Americans believe in some sort of elite pedophilia, satanic cult.
5 years ago... You know, if I said that 5 years ago, people would be like, Hillary Clinton, what? Like, not
I was saying, I was saying it 5 years ago, 5, 10, 15 years ago. I was saying it to people and they were looking at me like I was insane.
Yeah. And if you say it now, chances are half the people know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Isn't that messed up? And this was the world I wanted at one point when I was into the conspiracy. I'm like, everyone's going to wake up one day and they're going to know what's going on, man. And then, like, it's happening, and I'm like, put the lid back on the bottle. This is terrifying.
I sort of kind of see that as being similar to, like, a lot of sort of religious cults in that way. Like, there's going to be this mass awakening one day. Everyone's laughing at us now, but 2 years' time.
They'll be sorry.
And I sort of believe that a little bit for, like, 9/11 when I was in. It's sort of like, we're going to wake everyone up to 9/11, and then the polls on 9/11 haven't shifted in the 8 years since I left.
it's scary, and I don't know what the answer is. I know that there's a place for people like Brent and people like me who are, you know, trying to, like, be there for people when they realize, like, oh crap, I took a wrong turn, you know. And that's why Heather and I started Back to the Vax, was to give parents support, to give parents a sense of community, but also, like, we're not experts. So that's my big thing, because I don't want to be looked at as an expert. And that's what I tell people, like, we have some experts that believe the consensus of science, and I have them do Q&As in our group, but I never profess to be an expert. And any recommendations align with whatever the current guidelines for pediatrics is in your area. So that's what, if they're like, what vaccine should I get? Well, whatever you're comfortable with, because anxiety plays a big part in that. And two, whatever your catch-up schedule says for your area. So Canada will be different than the US, will be different than Australia, right? So whatever they say is what you should do, barring anxiety. And I get that. So that's the only reason we say, do only one if that's all you can do. But it's not out of, like, this alternative schedule is better. Like, we never recommend anything that isn't based in evidence. And the full schedule is based in evidence.
Because none of the four of us are experts in COVID or immunology or virology or any of the ologies. And it's very important that we all acknowledge sort of our limits there. So our last episode, we had Graham Botley on, who is an immunologist who specializes in virology. And
he was really good, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But the depth of knowledge that he has on the very specific pieces was just incredible. You talked a little bit about the sort of the you never go at variance to whatever the recommendations are in a region, and that does make sense. And it's obviously difficult to say, well, you should do this if a particular region doesn't support that. Do you think you're going to be under a little bit of pressure to break from that a little bit with what's happened in Florida, where there is, and I know we didn't discuss this question before.
I tell people to talk to their pediatrician. So what Florida has done goes against what 90% of the pediatricians recommend. Mm-hmm. So I would still say, like, talk to your pediatrician. I don't know if they totally barred it or just said there's no requirements. Like, can parents still do it if they choose to?
I think they don't recommend it currently. The Surgeon General's an FLCCC guy, so presumably he'd be happy enough to give you some warming products if you get COVID, because that'd be relevant.
Because I think right now the AAP still recommends it, so, and most of pediatricians work under that, and they'll still recommend it even if their government is being silly and turned it into a political decision.
Yeah.
But I'm not 100% sure how it works in Florida. I mean, it is a pretty kooky place.
Yeah. So I have another question. So I think it's more to do with the term anti-vaxxer, because, like, if you ask generally someone who is an anti-vaxxer, they don't generally perceive themselves. So they'll just say, I'm not an anti-vaxxer, I'm vaccine risk averse or some other
they'll say term.
And I'm like just warning people about the risks of autism or whatever, so they can make an informed choice or something like that.
And they think that's new. I have posts from like 2009 where I'm like, we should not be called anti-vaxxers. we should be pro-informed consent.
Yeah,
that kills me.
Informed consent if you're misinformed.
Pro-misconformed consent.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. David Gorski calls it misinformed refusal. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. My head was in my hands whenever you said that, Lydia.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's not a new thing. And that's when I say, I'm like, you're funny. I said, I tried to rebrand myself too. I have like the receipts to show you that I did the same thing. And it's because you don't want to be called something that brings back, you don't want to be associated with something negative, like bringing back diseases, but that's what you do when you talk against vaccination. Like, that is the single most medical breakthrough that has saved hands down the most lives, probably right next to antibiotics, you know? And to sit there and say that it never, and that's where my friend Heather noticed something too, when she was in the anti-vax group. She said, but we can't say like one vaccine has never helped anyone. And then they'll go, yes. And they all turned on her and threatened to kick, like, you know, like, what are you doing? Like, you can't say that. But she's like, but you can't say that one vaccine hasn't saved one person's life. Like, I get, we know there's risks, but we can't say that, can we? Like, I'm pretty sure that it has probably saved one person's life. Like, we can't say that. And that's when she started seeing, like, this is kind of a cult. Like, if I say that and they can't even like stand it when I do, like, that's pretty crazy.
It's one of the things that really frustrated me during this pandemic. I thought that once we got, you know, vaccines and they would be, you know, effective, and clearly they are effective, and although they're not as effective against infection as we had hoped, they're still keeping people out of hospital, they're still keeping people out of intensive care, they're still keeping people out of the morgue. Yeah. I thought that the sheer weight of the maths would mean that, you know, the likes of Big Tree would disappear, count as money, never be seen again. I thought that it would be the death of the anti-vax movement.
I know.
I don't know. I mean, you're probably the wrong person to ask. We should probably have Big Tree on this and ask him.
Yeah, I know.
How did they survive? How did their movement survive?
The appeal to contrarianism is greater than we believe, I think.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. So also, there is ways to misrepresent data, such as they can present, you know, the base rate fallacy where, oh, a majority of people who died are vaccinated. Or there's the Simpson paradox, where you could say, well, when like you've got everyone vaccinated apart from like kids, you can say, well, vaccinated people are way more likely to get strokes or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, so you've got base rate fallacy, Simpson's paradox. I think I'm missing one.
Bro, as I always say, all people with strokes drank a glass of water too.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, like, how do you know it wasn't that?
Oh yeah, there's absolute versus relative risk reduction as well, yeah. where they just get to say, the vaccine is 0.5% effective.
They love that.
I've worn a seatbelt every time I've got into a car, and thankfully, so far, I've never been involved in an accident which was big enough for it to cause any, to be required to be helpful.
Yeah.
And that's probably the experience of most people.
It's my experience.
Yeah. It doesn't make the seatbelt useless. I don't know. I just find it so frustrating. And I also find it really frustrating. You know, we went through with Graham, we went through the objections that people raised. And, you know, we go from ADE, which is not the case. We went from that.
It's been so long now. Like, ADE would be totally apparent by now.
Yep. It's been 2 years since the first person got their shot.
Exactly. They've got a big list of stuff and they just bounce on to the next one without thinking, well, hold on a sec. I'm sorry to rant about this. I know I'm not the subject of this interview, so this is really not what I wanted to have. But, you know, they just bounce on to the next thing about assessing. Well, the thing that we said 10 minutes ago and the people who were saying it 10 minutes ago, that was total crap and it was obvious crap. So maybe we'll have a little think before moving on. I don't understand why that doesn't happen, that introspection. It's just boom, next piece of crap. Boom, next piece of crap. It's like they're on ivermectin.
I know.
Sorry.
And I always go back to not just COVID, but I say, listen, I was one of you a lot longer than, like, you're probably new to anti-vax thinking. I'm like, I was around for swine flu as an anti-vaxxer. And they said similar things. They said that all the vaccinated people were going to die the following flu season, similar to ADE, right? Mm-hmm. And they said that it was going to sterilize people and cause miscarriage, and women won't be able to carry pregnancy anymore, and it was a population control thing.
Yeah.
They were certain of it. Back then, Rima LeBow, she's a doctor. She's really against the Codex Alimentarius. I'm sure Brent knows what that is.
Yeah.
And she would always go on about that, but her big thing was like, everyone's going to die from this flu shot, not this year, the next year, so we won't even expect it. And just, it's population control. And none of that stuff came to fruition. And they were all so sure of it. And I said, and then you guys just forget. You just move on. Like, don't you think that's a little funny how you guys made all these predictions about the swine flu shot that never came true? Like, you're not wondering about that right now? It's in the normal flu shot. Everyone gets it every year. You're not a little bit curious about, like, how none of that stuff came true?
This as well. Did you ever encounter when you were in microchips in the vaccine? Because Brent sort of showed me a video from 1993 which had that claim in it. So did you personally ever encounter that?
No, I never encountered that. Or if I did, I was like, that's crazy. So when I encountered crazy or conspiracy theories about vaccines, you want to know what I told myself? They're saying
those are like agents of the government making us look crazy.
They're making us look bad. They're trying to make us look bad.
Sorry, I was out there. I was the guy out there making you look bad.
Yeah, I was like,
controlled opposition.
I have real concerns and they're trying to make me look bad with my real concerns over here. Like, that's not a real concern and you're just making noise. So my real concerns are not addressed. That's how I felt.
That's so interesting because that's like the same thing in almost every community.
Right?
In a whole of the truth movement, whatever community you're in, if there's a different community that's kind of saying something different or a different thought that's being spun,
yeah,
you think it's like, oh, that's to make us look stupid.
Yeah, that's like, what's the word for that?
PSYOPs, controlled opposition.
Yeah, the PSYOP movement or whatever to make us look bad.
I wonder, states of truth is making the controlled demolition truthers look crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there is like some really out there conspiracies.
Oh, so, yeah.
That you could just, and there's always an explanation. Like, they can always explain it away. That's the thing about them, is that you can just come up with something else to explain it away. So even if you are being presented the right information, you just tell yourself, oh, that's just what the government wants me to know, or that's just a psyop, or like, you can never be proven wrong.
So as a question probably for all three of you then, with what you've just said, that there's a, you know, they can always come up with something, so you can never be proven wrong. So you've got some unfalsifiable thing and there's like a big ball of mud and just another thing can be added to it, and they'll make whatever adjustment needs to be made. And I think we've seen it with QAnon and so on.
Yeah.
With any piece of information that challenges your understanding of the world, no matter what it is, if something, I'm trying to think, if there was a piece of information that was consistency of the world literally being flat, like, I assume that would challenge our understanding of the world for all of us, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It certainly challenged mine, right? So let's imagine that we discovered that there's a serious chance that the world is literally flat. What should we ask about new information that looks to invalidate our existing information? Or what should we ask about our existing information in the light of new information? Because I don't think that it's healthy to simply glue stuff on while maintaining, you know, glue on contradictory stuff and have cognitive dissonance and so on.
Well, I like to just still be skeptical. Like right now, like the COVID vaccine is awesome because it pulled us out and gave people a way to protect themselves from death. But in terms of like ability to evade mutation and like I have like genuine criticisms as a non-expert, like we need a better vaccine. And I think it, you know, it did a good job, but I just think maybe, I don't know if we need to update it to whatever's currently circulating every year or however they want to work it. But the one that we have now is for the original strain. And the virus has changed so much in that many years, you know? And so I think I have legitimate criticisms. They're not, you know, that this is a satanic thing to control us all, and they just want my money. I'm not going to go that far with it, but it's okay to look at things with a skeptical lens and say, well, I think it could be better. You know, I think that that's always good. And, you know, if you have some really good evidence for something, the evidence to prove it wrong has to be much better. So you can't have like, it's like the whole vaccines cause autism thing, right? Like, let's say you had a small, I don't think that study exists. I'm not going to say that. But let's say there was a small study that said vaccines cause autism. And then a bigger study came out and said, no, we actually looked at bigger number and said like, no, it doesn't. So the next study to prove that they do cause autism would have to be even bigger, right? And more robust and better done. And so I think that's with anything.
Of course, there was a study that did say that, but it now literally says redacted on every page because it was Andrew Wakefield's fraudulent wank study. Yeah. Sorry, fraudulent study.
It was fraudulent, and it only contained 12 stories. And he was working on his own vaccine at the time.
Yeah, and it wasn't, he was trying to prove that in autistic children, the reason they had bowel problems was because of the measles vaccine, and that it potentially caused autism as well. And then, he was trying to come up, and he did that because he wanted to disparage it to create his new vaccine, much like Eden, who I think was planning it. And Malone has his own patent too, I believe. Don't quote me on that. He does.
And Phantom Bash.
Yeah. So like, there's reason why these people are, you know, disparaging certain vaccines.
Yeah, and Wakefield did colonoscopies on children.
They're not that they get painted as. Yeah, and taking blood work at a birthday party.
Yes. Yeah, I'll give you a fiver if you get them to take your blood. What?
Terrible, terrible man. It
feels like bad science as well.
Oh, yeah. Like, terrible. But yeah, and there's, I'll quote a study, and people like to argue with me about it, but there's a study with 600,000 children, the Danish study, that, you know, has unvaccinated children. And they'll say, well, it was only for MMR. I'm like, no. There's actually completely unvaccinated kids in that study. The question is about MMR, but in the study itself are completely unvaccinated children because some parents, it's a sibling study. So some of the parents thought maybe the vaccine caused autism for their children, and then they didn't vaccinate their subsequent children. And then their children ended up with autism anyway, because it's genetic in a lot of the cases. And, but they'll say, no, it's just for MMR. It's not the other vaccines. I'm like, no, there's a group of kids in that study that have no vaccine. But you can show them that and they still don't believe it. They still want to push the narrative. And I'll say, like, my son, he has autism. I didn't realize it till much later because I was so in that wellness movement that I thought autism was this nasty, horrible thing that was going to wreck my life and wreck my marriage and make everything hell. And my son is beautiful. Like, he's none of that. And he sees the world a little differently and he needs a little extra help here and there, but he's a beautiful, wonderful human being. And so when someone mentioned he might have autism, I was like, you shut your mouth because he's beautiful and perfect. But he's still beautiful and perfect. He's just autistic. Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah. I know parents of a child who, you know, has a form of autism. And you literally, without getting into who they are, you literally couldn't pick two people who you'd imagine be more qualified to work this out really quickly. And it took them, you know, it took them a while to understand exactly what was going on, what the son was presenting with, why, and so on. So, I mean, you should never beat yourself up about that anyway. Like you say, your son's beautiful and perfect and great.
Yeah. So, and he's really risen to the occasion, like every therapy goal pretty much, you know, smashed out of the park, so to speak. He's doing awesome. And it just speaks to evidence-based practices, you know, like I am not giving him a strict diet and bleach enemas and all this baloney to try to cure him. I'm supporting him with evidence-based therapy to help him navigate his world better.
Yeah, the bleach stuff seems so cruel.
You know, and I like to compare, like, here's how to judge a good autism therapy. It's a little off topic, but a long time ago when kids were left-handed, they were smacked for using their left hand. Their left hand was often tied behind them, so they couldn't use it, and they were forced to be right-handed. If your kid's autism therapy looks like that, I would question it. What we should be doing is giving them left-handed scissors and giving them, you know, pens that maybe don't smear as they write across their page. Like, that is what autism, you know, evidence-based treatment should look like for an autistic child. You're supporting them as they are. You're meeting them where they're at. You're not forcing them to fit this mold because everyone else is that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And so that's how I look at any therapy that is offered.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. That's crazy. I just think of that. Like, we used to like hit kids who were left-handed for using their left hand. We've come a long way, I think, in respect to how we treat children.
Yeah, 100%.
I had some questions for you that I wrote down. Because I've been listening to your podcast since we started speaking.
Oh, nice.
Like, I have, like, you know, for quite a few months now, I did delve into your first ones, and then I've been listening, like, every once in a while when you guys, like, release them. I went back over one of them because I remember enjoying the one with your mother-in-law.
Yeah.
Like, that was such a wonderful, wonderful discussion. On anyone else listening, you know, I'd say go listen to this podcast, Back to the Vax.
Yeah.
You know? And specifically the mother-in-law one. I think it might be episode 3 or 4 or somewhere around there.
It was a shorter one.
But what I really, when I was listening, I wanted to know, as you both had these opposing views, like, she obviously was administering vaccines and you were so against them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, with these opposing views, did that, would, you know, put your partner in an awkward position? Were you aware that maybe there was,
you know,
an awkward position? Because obviously she had said to your husband,
yeah,
that, you know, if anything happens to my grandchildren, that's on you. You know, were you aware of that?
No. My husband is very protective of me. He knows I have a lot of medical trauma. Like, I as I mentioned, I have pretty severe Crohn's disease, and I think he knew I was being really overprotective of our children. And his feeling was that, you know, we had a high rate of vaccination in our community that was probably protecting them, and that he was kind of banking on that to, you know, work. And he didn't want to alienate me or traumatize me, or, like, he's really protective of me. I'm a lucky woman.
Have you come across any sort of questions like that? Because the reason I ask is because of the, like, the people that get in touch with me, I hear a lot of things about, oh, my partner's going through this thing, they believe this thing, and, like, it's really hard on our relationship.
I know. I get a lot of those emails too.
Do you have any advice for the partners that are out there, you know, that to them or something?
I have what I call, like, a one trope method. So a lot of times anti-vaxxers, or even people with, you know, who believe conspiracies or whatever, they'll throw a million different things at you and you don't have time to disprove it all. And so my thing is like, pick one thing, pick what you hang your hat on as definitely true, and we'll talk about it. So, like, for me, that only because in my experience, that's how I stepped out of it, was being totally wrong about something and going, I have no way to work around this. So one of the experts I actually have in my group is a blood-brain barrier expert, Abraham Alamad. He's a PhD blood-brain barrier researcher who tries to design drugs to actually cross the blood-brain barrier to treat serious cancers like glioblastoma, which is a very lethal brain cancer. And he's like, I wish it was that easy to cross. It's not. Like, I cannot actually cross it. Like, that's what we're trying to do, so we can treat, you know, certain lethal cancers, especially in children. So, like, I'll have him answer questions about that, where parents are worried that the aluminum is going to cross their blood-brain barrier and cause autism or neurological damage, you know? Like, that's how I go, is like, pick one thing that you are certain of and then go from there and see if you can provide evidence that they can't get around.
What I think we're talking about when they throw loads of ideas. That has a name. It's called the Gish Gala.
Yes, Gish Gala.
Where you just come up with like loads of ideas. And you see it a lot on Twitter when you engage with some of these people. Like,
they have file folders. They copy and paste. They have links. They're ready for their Gish Gala. These expert anti-vaxxers are ready. They are armed with these quotes and links and videos of anecdotes. They're ready, you know.
Because it's like, you know, it was the bacteria in the gut which was causing the autism, then it was the mercury, then it was the aluminium. Yeah. Like, there's always a new thing.
Always a new thing. And like, even with the whole autism thing, like, I'm just realizing now, like, my father, who is schizophrenic, you know, but as a child, all of the descriptions of him sound like an autistic child, and autism genes and schizophrenia genes have a lot of overlap. And I think my dad was autistic first and then developed schizophrenia later, which can happen with people who are autistic. And so I'm like, I bet my dad was autistic and he got horribly beat in school, man. Like, because my parents are from the former Yugoslavia. They were not kind to kids. And my dad got punished for misbehaving. He was nonverbal until he was like six. I heard from his sisters and like stuff like that. I'm like, he was probably autistic too. And like, so yeah, my son has a lot of mannerisms that my dad has, like the way he walks and the way he moves his hands. And I think my dad had autism, you know, and I think there's no rise in autism. We just didn't know what to call it. And a lot of times, you know, especially 70 years ago, these kids were just branded as bad, or they were sent to institutions, you know, like, and not seen in society. And so, yeah, that's when people are like, what's causing the increase? I'm like, there really isn't an increase. I just think we treated them differently and also kind of put them out of sight.
The Gish Gala is so frustrating to deal with. And certainly on Twitter, it does feel like you don't even get links. You just get JPEGs.
It is as well.
It's turned into memes. It's turned into pictures and memes now. It's not even like words anymore. There's no war of words. It's just silly memes that have quotes by somebody who probably didn't even say that, and then they just share it virally. It's pretty crazy.
Like,
there's also sea lioning, where they'll come onto your post trying to ask a seemingly innocent question, but it's actually just a statement in disguise.
Yeah,
this is called a JAQING up.
Yeah. Oh, yes. That. Yeah.
yeah, as opposed to something which sounds similar, which is actually
fun. I tell people they're doing that all the time on Twitter when I get surrounded by them. One time I had to shut my Twitter off for a while because I said something, and then like I had dinner and I came back and my tweet had like 700 comments underneath it from, I just got swarmed by anti-vaxxers and conspiracy theorists. It was crazy. I was like, oh, okay, I gotta delete this tweet and just shut it off and close my account, because they've clearly like decided to get together and bother me. But that whole swarming thing is...
Yeah, on my Twitter account, I have seen it. So the very first post I did under this account was a description of how we know, from a legal perspective, phrase my words very carefully, how we know that what Michael Yeadon said about how certain tweets appeared in his account, on his Twitter account, wasn't accurate. I'm not going further than that, but the thing was, was about how we know that what he said wasn't correct. And I had a guy who turned up on the very first tweet from this account. And it must have been about a month. There were, you know, maybe half a dozen, maybe 9 or 10 people that he had engaged with who were going back and forward explaining why he was wrong. And he just bounced on to the next thing, And it was like he was going round in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
Several, probably for at least 2 or 3 times, tweeting out, you know, promotions for this podcast and Twitter space.
The irony.
yeah, we've had, you know, people who, you know, those one was today. The first thing they said was, yeah, but the Queen took ivermectin for COVID. And it's like, no, she didn't.
No, I saw that. I'm like, no, she didn't. You're funny.
The hilarious thing about engaging with a Gish Galloper is that you don't even need to be there. Because it's like, you just say one thing, they go on to the next thing. They could just be talking to themselves because they never actually acknowledge anything.
I said, are you, anti-vaxxers, are you tired of being wrong? You were wrong about this and you were wrong about that. Do you ever get tired of being wrong? And that really made them mad. Yeah. like I said, I think I had like 600 or 700 comments under that tweet. And I was like, oh God, I can't deal with this right now. Like, it's too much. And they're like, why aren't you answering? Why aren't you answering? Like, there's 700 freaking comments. I just went for dinner and came back. There's 700, like, I can't answer to 700 people. Like, it's impossible.
Yeah, the only way I found is dealing with a Gish Gap was to call really early. You know, to call out, right, bring up your next picture from your bag of memes or whatever it is, and try to make them realize, but sort of punish them for doing that. So either, okay, well, we're going to see another piece of nonsense, or we haven't addressed my response to that yet. That's, you know, like, there's nothing, there's nothing you can do, because it is just a fire hose, and I'm trying to make sure that Google Podcasts lets under 18s listen to this podcast, but a fire hose of nonsense children, that's definitely the word I was thinking of, a fire hose of nonsense, and you kind of have to just point that out and say, look, this is a massive fire hose. You have to point out the method or else you're done.
Lydia, do you find, like, with this Gish Gallop, do you find that because you was like such a anti-vax activist, that you are able to keep up with the Gish Gallop? Like, I can with the conspiracy stuff, because I know they already
try a new trope. That trope was around in 2008. It wasn't true then, and it's not true now. Like, I'm like, find something new. You guys recycle everything. Like, can you find something new?
Yeah.
When I'm against the Gish Gallop, I'd say, hey, well, I never received any pushback on the last thing I said. But eventually, if you engage with the Gish Galloper long enough, they will just repeat the first thing that they said, generally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they don't really have anything new to say. And then I'll get challenged to debate sometimes from anti-vaxxers. And I'm like, listen, I'm not an expert. I'm not debating you. I don't want to waste my time. I've given you information to go look into yourself. Like, these are all things. And I said, I know how debates with anti-vaxxers go. You guys don't debate the person. You talk to your audience. I saw Ben Tapper do a debate with my friend Isaac, and he was just bringing up anecdotes. And of course, everyone that was anti-vax thought he won. But anecdotes are not evidence. He has no evidence. And he just basically pandered to his audience, bringing up sad stories. And I'm like, that's not how to debate. That doesn't really prove anything.
The parents, they
know what happened to their children. So he's like painting himself as this like hero underdog that is exposing, you know, what is happening.
Isn't that interesting? The parents I see. So this is an anecdote, but I have heard stories of a child who was in to get vaccinated, and they had some sort of seizure or something within 15 minutes of being due to be vaccinated, because it actually happened slightly before, and it happened maybe 10 minutes later, 100% the parent would have blamed the vaccine. I would have blamed the vaccine. Everybody would blame the vaccine.
Oh, right? Like,
and that's what's so dangerous about anecdotes and about this whole mama bear parents know best thing. It's like,
they don't. I have a similar story to that, not as severe, but the night before my son's first COVID shot, he woke up screaming, my legs, oh my God, my legs. Had that happened the next day, I would be, you know, a little shaken.
You would be back in the old forums.
You know, I'd be like, oh my God. But no, he did that the night before. And then I was like, oh, it's probably just growing pains, you know, but that... if he did it the day of his shot, I'd be wondering what happened.
it's very hard not to rely on sort of the patterns and stuff that we see in the anecdotes and on our own experience. There's been a couple of times whenever I've had a drink and decided to cycle home. So literally a drink, cycled home, and been sick as a dog afterwards. Mm-hmm. And it's happened twice. And I'm not going to try to see if it was going to happen a third time.
Yeah.
You know?
Enough.
But I know that's just an anecdote. That's not data. It's so important that we need to, that we all understand the difference between anecdotes and data, and even between data and good data, because like we discussed, you know, you've got fallacy arguments, the Simpson's paradox, the base rate
fallacy.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm getting tired.
I think there is always that way to misrepresent the data.
Yeah.
Yes,
and there's also sharpshooter fallacy, but that's a bit more complicated. That comes from when they did a study of 900 different diseases with living near power lines, and they found out that one by sheer luck had a correlation. So that's sharpshooter fallacy.
Thank you very much, Lydia, for your time. And thank you very much, Ivor and Brent, for joining Lads on Tour this evening.
Lads on Tour.
Lads on Tour.
I like the little posters you make for all your little shows. It's kind of funny.
Next month we will have TBC on, so we'll find out soon. We've got a couple of exciting guests in the pipeline. We will let you know soon what's happening next month, who is coming to talk with us, and whether or not we're going to do it as a Twitter space. Okay.
Will you plug your podcast as well?
Yeah, yeah, plug your podcast.
My podcast is called Back to the Vax. You can find it on Spotify. You can find it on Anchor, Apple. I think it goes to a few other places. So yeah, it's called Back to the Vax. And I'm going to do an interview with a teen that vaccinated behind his parents' back.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
Yeah, that's my next podcast. It's going to be with a couple of teens from a vax team. And one of them is, he chose to get COVID vaccinated. He was allowed to in his state, but it was against his parents' wishes. So
there's going to be lots of, that's going to be a very controversial one.
Yeah.
Competence was a real, people freaked out about that here. They lost their minds. Mm-hmm. Because like a 14-year-old in the UK who can demonstrate that they're competent to understand whether or not they should have a
particular mental.
Yeah, if they're bright enough to make the decision, they get to make the decision. And lots of people here's minds were blown by that, as if it was like a new thing.
Yeah, but it's not. It's always been that way here too. But now that there's a new vaccine, now everyone's onto it. But like, teens have been allowed to get their own vaccines if they're proven competent to make that choice. Yeah.
So once again, thank you very much. I hope that everyone enjoys listening to this whenever it eventually is available on podcasts and on YouTube. All right. Thanks very much now.